Our guest this hour was stranded in Washington, D.C. for a day. He was rummaging around in a local bookstore, and he encountered Scott Thorson's memoir of his years as Liberace's lover. And he remembered a little bit of Liberace from his TV days when our guest was a young child, but recalled only headlines of the palimony suit against the entertainer. He became interested in Liberace and found him to be a more interesting and compelling figure the more he wrote. He has written a really fascinating book, Liberace, an American Boy. Darden Asbury Pyron is our guest this hour. And we're having, of course, the conversation this week because of the HBO movie that ran last Sunday, and I'm sure it'll be running again and again and again. Some of you, I'm sure, had a chance to see it, and I'm interested in your response to the movie as well, Behind the Candelabra, starring Michael Douglas and Matt Damon. So we'll talk about Liberace this hour of the program. And welcome to your phone calls, your thoughts about the film, and because he was born and grew up in West Allis, Wisconsin, I'm sure there are people listening who have memories of Liberace and saw him as he performed in various places in the state of Wisconsin. We'd love to hear from all of you during the course of the hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Darden, thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, loved your book. It's just, I didn't read all of it, but it just took on so much, American culture and being gay in America and family relationships and all of that. It was really well done. And you write in the preface to the book that people were surprised that you would devote serious attention to such a character. What does a dead, closeted queen performer adored by Midwestern grannies have to say to contemporary gay men? But he had a lot to say. And the whole culture did, didn't it? It's interesting as a history.
Yeah, I think so. I'm an historian as well as a biographer. I was trained at the University of Virginia, and all of my professors did life and times type history, so that the idea was certainly to reveal something about American history. But before you go on, I would like to jag on one thing that you said about, you know, what does he have to say to contemporary gay culture, contemporary queers? My suspicion is that he probably has more to say than they would like to hear. But beyond that, one of the themes of the book is that this was not, that his primary audience was not gay guys at all. It was a general American audience, frequently middle class, lower middle class, not necessarily, and that there's something that certainly transcends gay stuff or queer stuff,
right,
in his life and so forth.
Oh yeah, no doubt about that. I think I remember my mother loved Liberace, and my mother-in-law loved Liberace. Women,
everybody loved
Liberace. I know.
Actually, the people who dislike him most today seem to be contemporary gay guys.
Oh, that's so interesting. And why is that?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Why is that?
And part of this is simply prejudice. I would say prejudice within the gay community about what's proper deportment. That is, the norm of contemporary gay society as per gay marriage and all of this stuff is that gay guys are just like everybody else. And Liberace was not just like everybody else, and in effect made a virtue of being different, and not just queer, but a virtue of being different and of doing something odd and outlandish or outre, these kinds of things. And this is not normal within the at least within the PC aspect of gay community. He wasn't interested in getting married to another gay guy and that sort of stuff, and also the idea of being politicizing gay culture and politicizing sexuality. He didn't like that at all. He
mm-hmm.
was completely that was completely foreign to him. For him, gay stuff was about going to bed with other guys. It wasn't about political activity at all.
Yeah,
does that help?
he was a pretty conservative guy, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He played Harry Truman, and he played the Ronald Reagan White House, mm-hmm. the Democrats weren't real wild about him to begin with. So.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, there's a part early in the book where you talk about if you're growing up, you're a young kid and you're realizing that you're different in some way, your sexuality is different. When you look at Liberace's life, it's not as though there was somebody he could go to and say, this is going on with me. He had to figure all of this out in many ways by himself when you consider who his father was, and there wasn't anybody around, right? He didn't know there were gay men.
Yeah, I think so. Although, you know, this is, I got to know, I was the monitor, the old Christian Science monitor did an interview with me, and a couple of people have written me about this sort of stuff, people who are in their 70s and 80s. And relating to this and the absence of what is vulgarly called role models and so forth, working out yourself was a critical kind of element within his culture. At the same time, we don't really know. Was there somebody who shepherded him along or some, but by and large, he the role models or the models that he found were not gay ones, but people like Paderewski, for example, the great Polish pianist. So that there was a non-sexual model that he followed, and then other things fell into place behind that. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
So your question assumes your problem or issue assumes the priority of gay identity or sexual identity altogether, and the idea of putting sexual identity as a primary identity between 1919, when he was born, and even 1975 is just really alien. This wasn't people's primary identity at all.
Yeah. Well, he always had kind of a flamboyant identity, didn't he? I was so interested in the costumes he wore to school, and even though he was kind of a loner, it seemed to me from your writing that people thought, you know, this guy was pretty stylish in some ways.
This is kind of problematical because when people are giving reports of this stuff, it's after he's famous.
Oh.
But he was certainly an odd duck.
Yeah.
But he wanted idea of like, okay, this is who I am, and you make the best of it. So I think one of the chapters of the book, although I have hardly looked in my book in 14 or 15 years since it was written, was making a silk purse out of a sow's ear. This is my material. What's the kind of costume I cut out of it? And so he always made a virtue out of what other people would see as liabilities.
Mm-hmm. He liked to sew.
Yes.
Liked to cook.
Yes. Carve little figures out of soap.
You say that you came to respect him in some ways. You came even to admire him. His life taught you things. What did you come to respect about him and to admire about him?
One example is his when he's dying. He was infected with HIV probably in 81, 82, somewhere in there, and is dead 4 or 5 years later. And his ambition hasn't waned at all, and so he sets records at Radio City Music Hall that, as far as I know, haven't been matched since. And he set records for the time. And so he's dying. He's lost an enormous amount of weight. I think it was Phyllis Diller, one of his old friends, came backstage to see him, and he's gulping oxygen between acts.
Mm.
And she looked at him. She said, "Oh my!" Her phrase is, "Oh my God, he's dying. Mm. He's a dead man." And still, that sense of vitality, of keeping on trooping. There's a kind of heroism in that, I think. Mm. And also, I like the idea of okay, this is where we are. How do you make the best of it? So that those two qualities are extraordinary, I think. Mm. He never saw himself as a victim, for example.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw the film. Obviously, one of the reasons we're talking with you is because HBO made such a big thing about this movie, and they're going to show it again and again, and it got huge ratings over the weekend. I did say it see it. And I must say, I didn't like it very much. I mean, there were things that I kind of liked, but it seemed as though the whole focus of the film was sex and his relationship, his attraction to various boys, and of course the relationship, which was it had a lot of levels to it with Scott Thorson. But I don't know if they were trying to. I don't know why they did just that with it, because it led you to believe that he was a sex-craved, flamboyant guy who had some talent.
Yeah. The Scott Thorson book is interesting for itself. When he was on television with Larry King 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, or whenever, he admitted that he had not read the book himself, which is quite extraordinary, because we know that Larry King had not read the book himself. And so it's two people talking about stuff they don't know anything about. I love my country. I love my country, but it's just weird sometimes.
Yes.
And so the book, the odd things about the book, I don't know if they interviewed he was not actually a ghostwriter of the book. I think his name was Eric Thorleifson or something like that. I can't remember now. But how much of that is the ghostwriter? How much of it is putting these interviews together to make sense out of it? And of course, it's lots of sensational stuff as well. And it tends to emphasize the domestic and the personal and the private. And there is that, clearly that life that Liberace led, that all of us lead. I mean, not like Liberace, but we all have our private lives.
Yeah.
But it really ignored this the public dimension of Liberace's life, which is the other two movies that have been made about Liberace tend to celebrate the sexual stuff as well.
Hmm.
But he was simply an extraordinary performer. I think I have this stat somewhere that he was the highest paid. He was the most popular performer in the United States, with one brief little period between about 1952. And his death, that is, that is bigger than Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley even in the 50s, and that the flamboyant stuff has obscured his talent as a performer, as a man who can read an audience and respond to what the audience wants.
Mm-hmm.
In the worst sense, that's pandering. In the best sense, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to put it. You start the book with his birth, which is a fairly extraordinary birth as well. Mm-hmm. He was, in some ways, many cultures would believe that he was destined for genius, right? It was no
yes.
wonder that he was a prodigy, because...
Yes. His, that idea of being born with a call, that born with a veil... You know, this is interesting. Something that rational society, American society. I only heard this from this woman by the name of Tina Ansa, who is a wonderful novelist, black novelist, whose heroine was born under the veil and who had the ability to speak to ghosts and see ghosts and things. And my secretary, God rest her, she died last week. Herself was born with a veil, with a.
Oh.
Sack or whatever still around her, and the idea that this is special, that this makes you special, and so that's within a non-rational, I would say primitive societies, whatever, that's really important, and it was important to him, because that's, while he speaks to American industrial, suburban, urban society, you know, there's that traditional sense of local culture, both from the Polish culture of his mother, out in the boonies of Winnebago, like the family lived out there, and then his father was born in Naples. In Naples, if anybody's been to Naples, it remains of just this extraordinary backward, forward, wonderful place. It's one of my favorite cities in Europe.
Mm.
So that this alien tradition of how he was able, part of his genius, I think, is that how he was able to take both this kind of primitive culture with a sense of his own genius somehow or the other, which was certainly fostered by his parents, and adapted and blended to relate to American culture. And so in that regard, he's a kind of genius.
It is. No doubt about it. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about Liberace this hour, a conversation in some ways prompted by the HBO special. What did you think of that? We can talk about that as well. I didn't like it very much, but maybe I know a lot of people watched it and a lot of people liked it, too. It did get good reviews. I just thought there was too much sex. But at any rate, it prompted us to look for a really good biography, and I think this is probably the best around. Darden Asbury, Pyron, Liberace, An American Boy, which looks at the trajectory of his whole life, starting with his birth in West Allis, Wisconsin. 800-486-8655 is our number. Darden teaches history at Florida International University in Miami and is author of other books as well. Southern Daughter, The Life of Margaret Mitchell, and the editor of Recasting, Gone with the Wind in American Culture. Two phone calls from you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Liberace this hour of our program, and let's start our phone calls with Gene in Oshkosh. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Kathleen and Professor.
Hello.
excuse my voice. This may add a side to his abilities. When I was in the military, I was stationed with the Atomic Energy Commission, and we blew firecrackers off 100 miles north of Vegas. And one time, I would get in quite often, into Vegas quite often. And one time I saw Liberace was the lead entertainer in one of the major hotels. So I decided to go, being of Polish extraction from the south side of Milwaukee. the program was spectacular. Liberace was a spectacular pianist. Did some things by some of the Polish composers. But the thing I'd like to report is that I think at that time, and perhaps still, Las Vegas is the playground of the Hollywood set. And there were very often very other big names performing, or in the room where the show was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to be Bob Hope, mm-hmm, and someone else, a very big name, and I'm sorry, I don't remember it, but it really doesn't matter.
When was this? What's the time frame?
There.
What year, and Gene? What year was this, Gene?
Pardon me?
What year was this?
How old am I? Yes. 1955.
Huh. Oh, he was at his white, what he called his white hot period, a white heat period. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and what does that mean, white heat period?
When he was when he was so popular that he could sell anything to anybody and go anywhere, playing for the Queen, just extraordinary celebrity in this period, in the mid 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, may I make my point?
Yes, go ahead, Gene.
All right, thank you. The thing that really amazed me was not only his piano abilities, but the man was unbelievably funny, and he had a razor-sharp mind. I saw him put Bob Hope literally under the table.
Really?
Bob Hope simply couldn't keep up with the repartee and Liberace.
All right. He was funny. Would you agree, Darden?
Oh yes, he was hilariously funny, and this is part of the thing that the movie didn't dwell on. But
right.
You know, in public, he was as Gene says, he's very smart. I like writing books about smart people.
Hmm.
He's extremely, extremely smart and hilariously funny. He could make anybody laugh. You had to virtually make a conscious effort not to laugh if you went to one of his performances. Hmm. So that's a very cool observation. He's a very funny man.
Yeah.
Smart and funny.
Oh, the movie didn't show any of that at all. He was
not at all
funny. I want to talk a little bit more because we're just a couple miles from West Dallas as we speak to you here this morning, because you talk about his personal genius constituted the contours of his career. His audience appeal and the shape of it, the act itself, do not make sense except in the context of his social background, working class, blue collar, farmer, tan, heartland of the American Midwest. How does that help us make sense of him?
Well, first of all, that's probably a purple prose on my part. Sorry for that. But the sentiment is right. That is that this is, it's like he evolved, his aesthetic, in effect, is based on a kind of principle or an understanding that most people are just like him in one regard, but that most people never are able to get out of or transcend LaCrosse or Racine or West Dallas or West Milwaukee. And so it's like he is their conduit to some higher world or some, whether it's in its negative sense, this is escapism, but he saw escapism as fundamental to art. He didn't believe in naturalism and he didn't believe in realism whatsoever, if that's not obvious, but that in effect it's his the West Dallas and West Milwaukee stuff, not with Milwaukee itself, because Milwaukee is I thought was a very a sophisticated place, but that is lower class people who are stuck here, maybe because they want to be, but who have a sense of something finer or something better.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You make a lot of sense. The book makes a lot of sense.
But also, well, thank you for that. But
yeah.
Also, you know, he's for all the flamboyant stuff, he's a very conservative guy.
Oh, yes. And very Catholic. He's very Catholic.
Very Catholic and very, you know, I had a, one of the things that interested me in that book is like he had two sermons preached over him. The Irish priest who's delivering a sermon is very Irish and puritanical. The other priest, I think was German, but I'm not sure, is much more open and, you know, like Liberace himself was. He was not a theological Catholic, but he's what I call an aesthetic Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So much more into the ceremonies of the church and so forth. And one of the things that was fun about doing the book is when I'm walking the streets where his house was, it still is, as a matter of fact, and walking from his house to the high school and from his house to the church, where I don't have record that he was baptized there, but I had record that his sister was baptized there, and looking at the church and thinking about the nature of services there and how he himself might have related to a traditional pre-Vatican II Mass. So very Catholic.
Yeah. Virginia in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, good morning to you both. Glad that I'm on the air. I have a question first and then a comment for Darden, and that is, now Darden, I came into the program a couple minutes late today, and I heard you mention the name Baldoni.
I can't hear you very well for some reason.
Yeah, what was the name, Virginia? I couldn't hear that either.
It was Baldoni.
Baldoni?
Yeah.
Did you mention that name, Darden?
I don't think so.
Yeah. What was the second point, Virginia?
Okay. The comment I have is this. I knew a lady some years ago, at least 25 years ago, and she was about 90 at that time, and she would tell me different stories of her life. And she had been a model downtown at one of the department stores. And one of her stories is that she knew Liberace as a child, and she, I guess they were out playing or whatever they were doing, and she could hear his mother calling, Liberace, come home, it's time for your lesson. And I didn't think much about it at that time, but now that I read that Debbie Reynolds has played his mother, and that she was somewhat of a, maybe a headstrong lady. I don't know if that would be the a good description, but it kind of makes sense to me.
She was a very prominent figure in his life, wasn't she, Jordan?
She would have called him Wally, probably, or maybe Walter, not Liberace.
Right.
But he had very ambivalent feelings about her. Something that's a part of his traditional stuff is that despite his personal, maybe even dislike of his mother, and certain anxieties with his brothers, and maybe even his sister, although less with his sister, he is intensely, intensely loyal. So we were talking about some kind of primitive values, like the mystery stuff of being born with a call and that sort of stuff. But another part of a primitive, I put it in quotation marks, value is intense, intense family loyalty. And so Scott Thorson never completely understood this, not having any proper family himself, but very loyal to family and also extremely loyal to friends. So I don't know whether that helps or not, but yeah. He didn't really like his mother, and she was not a real attractive person.
Well, his father, he was estranged from his father. His father was a taskmaster, wasn't he?
Yes. He never really made up to his father after his father left the family in the, I think, probably in the late 30s. I think his parents divorced in around 1941 or something like that. He's about 20 when his parents divorced, but they'd been estranged for a long time. He never really made up to his dad.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Virginia, very much for the call. So some of the juicy parts of the film, and you mentioned his going to, I think it was in Wausau, he encountered the other gay men and realized there were other gay men when he was playing in the saloon in Wausau. Is it true that his first sexual experience was with a Green Bay Packer?
Well, he has two versions of this, which were very interesting to me. One version is what is normally taken as a straight guy's fantasy of your first girl, a tart with heart. That is an older mother figure. So that's kind of a classic trope in straight culture. And the classic trope in gay culture is making it with a football player. And he gave both two versions of this. He told Scott Thorson about the Green Bay Packers one, and he told the public the one about the tart with heart, losing his virginity, as it were. If both of them were true, if neither of them were true, who knows? But he's also and this is one of the things that I don't know if the movie did it correctly or not. He's very randy. He's willing to get it on almost any time with almost anybody. So again, this is the movie tended to emphasize him being a sexual predator of young boys. He's just really randy. He just likes to have sex all the time. So that's the truth throughout his life. So
why did he carry on? And I'm wondering if people really knew that he was a gay man, or put this in the context of the times, because he carried on this charade about, his, who was it, the swimmer, who was it, the love of his life, and he was dating some people like Mae West, I think.
Yeah.
Why didn't he just say, I'm a gay man? Would that just have been too much for America at that time?
Dare I ask how old you are, Kathleen? No, I will not ask that. But this is an entirely different world. So that, as I told before, that probably the greatest anxiety that Liberace's life raises the most problems among out, young, Harvard and Princeton-educated gay guys.
Mm-hmm.
That is still not really problematical, but if you take that model and try to project it into the 1950s, 1960s, or even 70s and 80s,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you follow anything about the AIDS epidemic as it's hitting in the 80s and 90s, this is the most colossal outing process, and it's just not natural. It's not people making public declarations of your faith, as it were, value. About your sexual orientation or who you like to go to bed with. This is not normal at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, and you can take it in from, it's not just the gay stuff, it's anything. President Kennedy who's as randy as Liberace,
right?
Earls. This is not a subject of public discourse. So that then when you get the queer stuff, which is doubly forbidden, as it were, and when the Liberace book came out, you know, people would call me like, "Why is he a hypocrite?" And I'm like, you give him a break. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's simply a different world,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure that it's a better or worse world than the notion of basketball players declaring they want to go to bed with other guys or football players or whoever. You know, it's simply a different world. We live in a different world from that.
Yeah, you don't think it's a better world that people are open about sexuality? Not most people, but a lot. You don't think so?
No.
Why?
I'm not convinced of that.
Really?
Because it's like the part of the problem that I think Liberace's life is different is that if you have the idea of saying, "I am a gay guy," or "I want to go to," you make public declarations of who you like to bed, for example. The suggestion behind that is that we have mono identities, and most of it, I mean, we all have multiple identities. Like with Liberace, he believes in traditional family. He's a traditional Catholic. He's a notable performer, and he also likes to go to bed with gay guys, with other men. And that to say that one of those values trumps all the others, in part to ask the question that you asked suggests that sexual identity is primary. And I'm just not sure that it is. But again, this is my reactionary notion about these things. I'm very skeptical of identity politics, for example.
I just think it would have been an easier life for him when you hear of, you know, the stories of all the young men who were unable to tell their parents about their sexuality and tell society, some leading to suicides of young people because...
Oh, please, please, please. I think that's a part of the whole, with all the regard to your saint itself, a part of the contemporary discourse about the nature of gay stuff and sexuality and all the rest. It's like one of my students produced a really nice book, and I hope he gets to be famous too, on gay culture in Miami between about 1940 and the AIDS epidemic. And he's like, "Oh, coming out of the closet," and so forth. Like, I was living here, and I wasn't blind. I could look around, and I could see that there were gay clubs all over the place.
Right.
And gay businessman, the gay guy ran for mayor of Miami, openly gay guy in 1978, well before the politicization of sexuality and gay identity took place. And it was like, come out of the darkness into the light? And no, it was like pretty open altogether. So I think that's a part of the rhetoric that people have used. And same thing, dare I say it, about abortion movement and racial issues as well. So... that was it really those days really so horrible? But again, I'm kind of reactionary on all of this.
Well, I've talked to young people who've lived that, who have, you know, really been depressed by it and at the point of being suicidal. I mean, I've talked to gay people who have felt that way. You can't discount how they've lived or what their experience has been, can you?
I'm skeptical of it. That it puts a... that the rhetoric of, say, the evils of the closet puts a premium, so that if that's a part of the contemporary discourse and part of the contemporary rhetoric, that people speak to that. You know, so if you look at books, you know, other books on gay culture, in addition, for example, like George Chauncey's wonderful book on gay New York, it's a really wonderful book, and people live perfectly... natural life. It's not an openly gay life, but you find your level. And I think that contemporary gay politics, for example, has a vested interest in emphasizing suicidal youths and that sort of thing. But again, this is, I don't know how much of this is either your side or mine is provable by empirical data.
Let's go to some Facebook comments. John on Facebook remembers Liberace's brother George, who was a respected violinist and appeared with him on occasion, had his Stradivarius violin stolen after an appearance in Chicago. John says, "I remember it as a big item on the evening news."
I didn't know George had a Stradivarius. I'm a little skeptical of that. Not impossible, but George Liberace was not just occasionally, but he was an extremely important part of the of Liberace's act and a part of Liberace's whole performance. So George never spoke, and so that this is in part by Liberace's calculation of how performance works is another part of his genius. But George broke with him in around 59 or so because over the sexual stuff, so that Liberace had become he was like testing the limits of legality in terms of being very, very blatant in his private life. And George said, you shouldn't do this. You should back off. And Liberace refused. And so they were estranged. He and his brother were estranged for probably close to a decade.
Oh, my. Even though George had been married 5 times, right?
Yes. Well, it's different. What's acceptable sexuality and unacceptable
exactly.
sexuality?
Exactly. Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. First of all, I really am enjoying this conversation, and I hope your guest actually writes a book or at least a blog about the identity concept, and I think that's fabulous that you have that concept about freedom of identity. But my comment's actually about Kathleen, about your reaction to the show and not liking it, and I had the same exact reaction. But I think that the plastic surgery part of it was probably even more intense to me than even the sexuality. But
oh,
after
right.
I thought about it a lot, after I thought about watching it, because I just couldn't, I just kept thinking about the show and thinking about the show, I realized that, well, I didn't like it as much at first. Now I remember when I was watching it, I did feel sort of transported back to the being a kid in the late 70s, early 80s, and that kind of campy thing that he brought to the TV, and my mom was transfixed by it, and people were just really into it, and I just really remember that. I thought the way that it was directed and written was very campy and sort of like that, so that I did appreciate.
Yeah. Let's talk about that plastic surgery for those who don't know what we're talking about.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Did Scott have plastic surgery so he would look more like Liberace?
Yes.
That is pretty bizarre.
This is what first attracted me to Liberace.
Really?
I'm looking at the picture, and when I see the book, and as you cited at the beginning of the show, and I'm looking at the picture, I'm like, Mother of God! What is going on? And I was on book tour at that time for my Margaret Mitchell book, and one of the guys showing me around was a plastic surgeon, and I asked him about it, and I said, you know, this is just weird. And he said, yes, it's really weird. But I didn't emphasize the business about plastic surgery in general, which is super, super interesting to me. That is, why anybody has plastic surgery at all, and why it has become a norm in American society now. It's nothing to see people with just all kinds of facelifts and other kind of lifts going on. So that's one thing. But then which is super interesting for itself. It's just fascinating.
Right. Yeah, it is.
Nobody's explored the other thing about how the plastic surgery bit, it plays into the homosexual stuff or the family part. The idea that he really kind of conceived Scott Thorson as not son, not clone. It's like he wanted to make him in some ways a part of his family as
mm-hmm.
well. So that, and he had the money and the ability to do that, which of course is interesting for itself. But I thought that was the thing that attracted me to Liberace.
Oh, that's fascinating.
This is just the weirdest thing.
Yeah, ever. Yeah, very ever. Weird thing. Very weird thing. I'm glad you brought that up, Ian. And thank you for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the author of Liberace, An American Boy. Darden Asbury Pyron is our guest, and our conversation prompted by the HBO film, which aired on Sunday, and it will repeat. And a lot of people watched that show. We're going to hear a little Liberace, too, because we want to talk about his voice. He had a distinctive voice and had problems with his voice early in life, which Darden talks about. So be on the listen. We'll hear that in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
time.
And that, of course, Liberace. You gotta like that. The guy was a performer, and those fingers really moved along those ivories, didn't they? I mean, I love to hear him play.
he's a funny guy.
Yeah. His voice, we heard him speak a little bit. I found the part of your book interesting that he had this very, it wasn't completely Midwestern, I don't think, but this kind of fuzzy nasal way of speaking. But he had problems with his speaking voice when he was very young, didn't he?
Yes. His family was worried about him and had him go to specialists and so forth. But his voice, I mean, completely aside from that, you know, he certainly had a weird voice. So, and, you know, it's very, very distinctive and easily imitatable. In some ways, I see this, that he even plays this as a part of this kind of, a commodifiable aspect of his performance.
Nobody ever told him you need to change this a little bit? It would be better on television if you were in a different register?
Well, one thing about somebody complained about his telling the same jokes over and over and over, and they said, "When are you going to stop, you know, stop repeating the same jokes?" And his response was, "When people stop laughing." So that people could have told him all sorts, given him all sorts of advice, but the voice thing, I don't know anybody ever told him that he ought to, you know, butch up his voice or something, or make it sound less Midwestern,
mm-hmm.
But that, yeah. It was a part of who he was, and in some ways he even celebrated it.
Mm-hmm.
My suspicion, although I didn't say this in the book, I didn't talk about his voice very much in performance, but this, my sense is that he was so clever, and he's such a good performer, that he saw this as a part of the kind of sellable commodity that he was selling to audiences and so forth.
Yeah.
But don't press me on that.
Okay.
I've never thought about it before.
All right. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Liberace, and we're talking with the author of a really complete book about Liberace, Liberace, An American Boy. Darden Asbury Pyron is our guest, and lines are open for you. We're doing this because of the HBO film, and feel free to review the HBO film for us as well. I'm wondering about the influence that he may have had, or if this is going too far, Darden, to look at how he may have broken down traditional sexual or gender boundaries. Was he influential in that regard at all? Did people feel freer to express themselves in a flamboyant fashion?
Off the top of my head, I'd say no. That is, that he's really, I mean, it all depends. So people like Elton John, who loved Liberace, Madonna, Lady Gaga is somebody today who does the same kind of spectacular, over-the-top kind of things. I don't know. Elton John credits Liberace. The other people, I'm not sure, but I would say that his kind of over-the-top performance, what he called topping, is a kind of natural performance.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on a minute. My telephone might be going dead. I'm going to swap to my other telephone.
Oh, okay. Let me just give the phone number again. We'll go to more of your phone calls.
Hello?
Yeah,
okay,
momentarily.
Here I am.
Okay, fine. We're good.
Okay.
Let's go to Matt in Milwaukee next. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I had a real interesting experience where we had purchased a house a number of years ago, and we were getting junk mail for a woman that had died in the 30s, and we tracked down her son, who was in his 80s, and he came by and got the mail and told us all these stories about his house, and that his mother had worked with Liberace's mother at WTMJ.
Oh, yes.
And, and that this gentleman's story, and he was a jazz musician himself, and his story was that his sister and Liberace took piano lessons together from Liberace's mother, and the gentleman in question is his mother was the whistler at the live studios of WTMJ, and that Liberace's mother was the piano player.
Yeah, she was not the piano. He had a teacher who was very influential. Florence Kelly?
Yes.
It wasn't his mom who taught him to play.
She didn't. Mrs. Liberace didn't seem to be very musical at all. And a part of the conflict that they had in the family is that the dad wanted everybody to be musical in the family, and she's much tighter about things, according to Liberace himself, and that she was resentful of music lessons and so forth.
Yeah, that WTMJ story is interesting. He didn't practice as much as he should have, right? And I think it was word got back, and he was embarrassed because the musicians were in the lobby outside, and he hadn't memorized the piece he was supposed to,
yes.
And his father was furious.
Yes, his teacher was, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt, very much for the call. Lynn in Oregon. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I remember watching him when I was about 10, and when he would lean to the audience with that whispery voice and say, "Hey, you want to see the lining of my jacket?
Yeah.
It has diamonds in it, too." He was just so delighted and giggly about it. The audience just loved him. And so did I. Plus, he was operating in an era when Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and Jackie Gleason were all out there on TV,
yeah.
And he didn't seem so weird.
That's true. Right? And Elvis liked him, too. There's a picture in the book, isn't there, of Elvis in the front row at one of Liberace's concerts.
Elvis loved him.
Thank you very much, Lynn, for the call. Roger in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Hi, I'd just like to comment about the 50s TV music. Liberace with the beautiful candelabra and the touch of elegance. And the interesting thing about the other Polish boy who had the TV musical, which Lester Paul was, and his great groundbreaking work in guitar and music music recording.
Yes.
And it's interesting this convergence took place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hmm. It is interesting that they came from this part of the country, from here, isn't it, Darden?
Pardon?
We produce...
I'm not sure. Yeah, this was my first foray into the Midwest or Midwestern culture, except for a summer in 1961 when I worked at a summer camp in Upper Michigan.
Oh.
And so I can't really speak to the question.
All right. Well, you don't know what you've been missing, sir. It's the best place. It's the best place in the whole country.
It was beautiful when I was there.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. Darden Asbury Pyron, our guest. And the book is Liberace, An American Boy. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, just a few blocks away from where Liberace was born. Thanks for listening.
Embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well.